there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for the next hour of medical news, science, and healthcare in the news, answers to your questions via email and phone. It's all here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for professional consultation. Well, I have some wonderful news stories and also a lot of emails, but I want to pick up a thread that I left dangling a couple of shows ago regarding the California health plan that went into place for people with pre-existing conditions. And I promised that I would look into that and give you a little executive summary. The website is www.pcip.ca.gov, and we'll post that at askdrdawn.com so that you can link to it. The short version here is that you have to have a pre-existing condition that has resulted in your being denied health insurance, and you need proof of that in terms of a denial letter of some kind. And you have to have been without health insurance for 6 months. If you meet those criteria, you can qualify for what looks like a pretty decent health plan, and it is subsidized, so the upper limits of cost are not so horrible that a person couldn't afford it. So this is a step forward. It's a tiny, eeny-weeny baby step in the direction we need to be going, but it does exist. So for those of us who haven't been without health care insurance for 6 months, we don't qualify. If you are currently in Medicaid or Medi-Cal in the state of California, of course, there are a lot of different odd special rules that you need to look at. And for that, I'd send you to the website. We're not going to get into that here. But I wanted to follow up on that because I felt it was important to pat us on the back a little bit in California for having anything. As soon as the door was opened, this was moved into place. And while it's very dilute compared to the healthcare reform that passed in California, was vetoed by the governor, it's still something. So that's pcip.ca.gov. And I want to start with a couple of emails. This from Elise in Springfield, Illinois. Dr. Dawn, I listened to the podcast. My mother, who's in her early 70s, recently had a bout of pneumonia. She ended up with fluid on her lungs. This was back in December. Since then, the doctor has had her come in for 3 x-rays. Mom's feeling fine now. The doctor wants to do a CAT scan to check for scarring. We're wondering if that is really necessary and why would the doctor want this? Well, I suspect, Elise, that your mother has a persistent spot on her lung and the quote-unquote scar that your doctor wants to look at with the CT is scar versus cancer. Often we do discover lung cancers because they block the passageways by their growth and cause a pneumonia. And so the person comes in, they've got a pneumonia. It's like, well, treat the pneumonia. And then there's this little spot left behind that was what caused the pneumonia in the first place. And when we don't see that spot go away after an appropriate interval, a month would be a reasonable interval here, then a CT scan is indicated to see if, in fact, you're looking at a cancer. Whether that cancer would be curable or not is another story, but a CT is relatively non-invasive. X-rays go through your body, but it's certainly, compared to a bronchoscopy or other an open chest biopsy, the best way to go. So I would follow your doctor's advice on that one. This one from Indiana. Hello out there in the Midwest, and thank you for listening so much. This from Erin. Erin is 45 and perimenopausal. I'm going to abbreviate her email. I've been dealing with hot flashes on and off for the past year, and I tried some black cohosh, didn't work. And I went to Google Scholar and found a publication in the Journal of Oncology titled The Effect of Oral Magnesium on Hot Flashes in Breast Cancer Survivors. And we'll go ahead and post the link to that for those of you who are interested. So she tried it. And what Elise tells us is she took 300 of magnesium in the mornings, 300 milligrams at night. And after 4 or 5 days, her hot flashes were gone away. And she was very, very happy with her results and wanted to share that with the rest of the nation, at least the little Ask Dr. Dawn nation that listens to this show. Donna in Concord, North Carolina, writes, I'm 54, lift weights twice a week, and do Pilates and yoga twice a week. But over the last 6 months, I've lost about 10 pounds, which I'm happy about, and have noted a great increase in my face and neck wrinkles. I eat a low-carb diet, plenty of protein. I'd like to look my best, control hot flashes, and be able to sleep. Not being able to sleep really affects my quality of life. If you don't feel that hormones are safe and appropriate, what other solutions would you suggest? So, Donna, let me first start by saying that I am a cautious advocate of the use of bioidentical hormones, both for males and females, for dealing with deterioration, basically, of the endocrine system, which occurs in middle age. In men, it happens slowly. In women, it happens more rapidly. But the endocrine system is one great giant web. So as your estrogen levels drop precipitously, your ability to deal with stress, the ability of your biorhythm to produce good quality sleep through the night, the effectiveness of your adrenal glands, all sorts of things deteriorate as well. So I like rebalancing them, and I think it's an appropriate thing to do. But there's no one-size-fits-all solution here. I am at the moment advocating the use of topical bioidentical hormones for hot flashes. And, of course, it will help with your sleep and your bones, and maybe with your skin. The reason I'm supporting topicals is because a recent study came out that showed that the use of topical estrogen does not cause an increase in deep venous thrombosis or blood clots in the legs or pulmonary embolism. Now, we don't have the 10 or 15-year data that says that it's not also going to bump the risk of stroke or heart disease, but that risk is related to the blood clotting effect of the estrogen. And if you're not seeing it in the veins of the feet and legs, I don't think you're going to be seeing it in the heart or the carotid artery. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we won't see those complications of estrogen when it's used topically. And that has to do with the fact that it doesn't go through the liver. That's all good. It's not established, but I would kind of bet on it, so to speak, based on the physiology. With respect to breast cancer, well, that's a really complicated issue. There may be a small increase in breast cancer. Whether it's meaningful in terms of survival, no one's ever been able to establish. In terms of case detection rates, there are more. And certainly, if you're using estrogen, it's easier to find your cancers. So that introduces a confound in when you try to compare cancer rates. But I think every woman has to look at her own risks there and make her own decisions based on what's she going to gain and what the risk is for her. With respect to facial wrinkles, you know, I'm not optimistic that going on bioidentical hormones is going to fix that. When you lost the weight, you lost subcutaneous fat, and that fat you don't really want back. You could learn to love your wrinkles. After about a year of persistent weight loss, that's what you're going to have. The skin will have tightened up as much as it's going to. And there is an entire industry out there, Donna, that does fillers, lasers, microdermabrasion, radiofrequency therapy, all sorts of things to rejuvenate and tighten up slackening skin. It's a huge growth industry in our culture, and I give you permission to go out there and do something cosmetic if you don't like your face. I see no reason why you shouldn't. We dye our hair, we wear tinted contact lenses, we have all sorts of body art put on our bodies. I don't think there's much difference between a tattoo and a Botox injection. As far as I'm concerned, they're pretty much the same sort of personal manipulation of your appearance. So let's go to Beulah in Carmel. Hello, Beulah, and thank you for waiting.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
I'm calling to see if you have had any experience with irritable bowel syndrome or something like it happening after colonoscopy. In 2006, I had a colonoscopy and very soon afterwards started this, what is like irritable bowel syndrome, but I don't have bloating and I don't have any pain or discomfort.
Well, in what way is it like irritable bowel then?
It's a diarrhea.
All right.
Very consistently. And it would be, first thing in the morning, I would have a perfectly good bowel movement, and about 5 minutes later, I would dash to the bathroom with diarrhea.
Okay.
This went on for about a year, on and off, and my doctor was just about to stool test, mm-hmm. and it stopped. And I had a couple of years with no problem at all. And then towards the end of last year, it started again with a vengeance.
But without you having done a bowel prep or had a colonoscopy, it just started again?
It's just started, yes, without okay. another colonoscopy.
Okay.
And we've done stool tests that show nothing, blood tests that show nothing, stopping a lot of things I was eating, which made it no difference at all.
Okay.
And I wondered if you'd ever come across anything like that.
Well, the answer to a could it question, which could colonoscopy cause this, is always yes. There's always a possibility. Could. Rarely is something completely impossible. But this is extremely unusual, and given how common colonoscopies are, I can tell you that I've had maybe one other person per decade with a similar complaint. So coincidence is high on my list, would have been anyway, and then with you telling me that it went away and then came back, coincidence went up even more on my list. We tend to associate things which occur together, and sometimes the prep for a colonoscopy might be a trigger. There's very, very strong efforts made to sterilize the instrument between use, so the chances of you having gotten a parasite or a bacterium from the previous person upon whom that instrument was used is very, very slight. It's possible, but very unlikely. And the persistence for a year of the diarrhea makes that unlikely. And how you're describing it is interesting. So my first thought would be pancreatic insufficiency. So it might be that you need to use digestive enzymes, and you can obtain those at a health food store.
Yes, I've been using digestive enzymes, but yes. they have not made a difference.
They have not, okay. And then the other thing that crosses my mind is that you have an exaggerated gastrocolic reflex, because the timing,
gastrocolic reflex.
Mm-hmm. And this could be from caffeine or just even a hot beverage or anything that would expand the stomach.
I virtually never have a hot beverage. Mm-hmm. I don't drink any coffee.
Yes, but if you had water even, if you had an exaggerated reflex, then mm-hmm. you might get up in the morning, have your normal bowel movement, have a glass of water or juice, and then have your diarrhea as a result of the triggering of a premature emptying of the colon by the stretching of the stomach. Think back to a little baby. And it's very classic when one has an infant. You feed the infant and you change the diaper because the act of filling the stomach triggers a bowel movement. And that's mm-hmm. a primitive reflex that we sort of suppress as we get older, but it doesn't ever go away entirely, and sometimes it can become exaggerated. So that would be the other possibility that I would throw out there. I don't know that you'll be able to cure it if that's what it is. It may be a live with it thing.
Why would that be on for a year and then off for a couple of years?
Stuff does that. I mean, when your reflexes start to go, or they start to exaggerate or become perturbed, they come and go.
Oh, I see.
So why did they tell us it was going to rain and I'm looking out the window and the sun is shining on me? You know,
yes,
well,
yes.
You do your best, but there's some things that are inherently unpredictable and inconsistent. And so I'm afraid that those are my reactions to you. Not a lot to suggest in terms of what might be helpful. Obviously, there are bowel limiting agents like Imodium. You might be a person who takes Imodium every morning.
How much Imodium can you use?
Well, you can use about 4 of the 2 milligram pills a day safely. I would hope you didn't need to do that every day.
No, but you can use it sort of forever if necessary.
If necessary. Perhaps for you the strategy is, assuming that you need to fix this, I mean, it's not altogether clear that this is a big deal, but if you need to fix it, then you could experiment.
Well, yes, it means that I sort of more or less stuck in the house.
Well, if that's the case, then you might try that, taking the Imodium in the morning. I'm sure you've been thoroughly checked out, so it makes sense at this point to start experimenting with different strategies. I'll see if I can come up with anything else. I know you're a regular listener, Bueller.
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I want to take another email before we go to our next caller. This one to Elizabeth in Maryland. This was one we didn't get to last week because I unfortunately was absent from the program. Sorry about that. Sometimes the doctor is sick. I'm a 57-year-old healthy female, and I've been exercising intermittently my whole life. Recently, I'm in a good phase, been going to the gym 5 days a week. I'm reading conflicting information about using a heart rate monitor for aerobic exercise. If I exercise at 50 to 70% of my heart rate, which is 130 to 150, it doesn't feel like I'm doing much. Yet if I try to jog, my heart rate goes up to about 90% of my maximum, and I cannot sustain it for more than 4 to 5 minutes. And I'm hopeless in the spinning class and get exhausted within the first 5 minutes with the instructor yelling, go faster, blah, blah, blah. What resources would you recommend on this topic? Elizabeth, those two fingers on your right hand, your index and your long finger, need to be educated to take your pulse in your neck by yourself and not rely on the heart rate monitor at the gym. Once you start moving, heart rate monitors become very inaccurate. And what I suspect is happening is that you're not getting up actually to 150 beats per minute. I suspect you're maybe down at 110 and the movement is causing the monitor to read extra beats. And so learn to take your pulse and check the heart rate monitor to see if it's accurate. I don't know too many people who can exercise at 150 beats per minute and not feel like they're doing much. So I think your measurement is off. That being said, from what you're describing about the jogging and the spin class, you've got about 5 minutes of capacity there. You're deconditioned and you need to work on it. And you will probably find that if you really get to 135, 140 beats per minute while you're exercising and check it with your fingers, that you'll feel like you're working. And then you gradually increase that time, and that's how you build aerobic fitness. I think you're getting faked out by the heart rate monitor on the apparatus. Let's go to Brad in Watsonville. Hello, Brad, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Don. Thank you. In fact, I'm calling about my father who's been suffering chronic diarrhea, and it sounds somewhat like your last caller, actually. He's about 90 years old, and of the last couple months, he's had fairly regular chronic diarrhea. In fact, he ended up in the hospital for it, and then was then in rehab for a month trying to recover and build up his muscle strength. He's been taking Lomotil and also Imodium, but they just don't seem to knock it out. And while he was in the hospital, they also put him on an antibiotic. So, I mean, it sounds like your sense maybe this is just a reflexive thing as opposed to being something related to his meds or food.
Well, the advice I gave before was specific to that caller, and your father has some other possibilities to be looked into first. One of which is we need to be sure he's had stool cultures and that he has been checked for parasites, and particularly for Giardia.
They did check that in the hospital, yes.
Okay. And hopefully those tests, which are not 100% accurate, were accurate in his case. The fact that he got antibiotics for diarrhea means he has a disrupted bowel flora. If he didn't before, he does now. So the use of probiotics is an important part of bowel recovery.
Okay.
And I would also get strong pancreatic enzymes and maybe betaine hydrochloride, which is hydrochloric acid, because at that age, there's a good chance that at the top end, he's not breaking down the food, and therefore it's not broken down in a form that can be absorbed, so he may be getting diarrhea. Remember, absorption occurs in the small intestine, absorption of nutrients. And if you have, let's say, hardening of the arteries, atherosclerosis, things like that, you may have a hard time getting enough blood to the small bowel to absorb all the nutrients, to take everything that's there.
He does have that problem too, yeah.
Well, you know, it's a good bet at that age. So there may be some vascular insufficiency that's contributing to this as well. And it's often a combination of factors. But you can't really help the vascular insufficiency. You can try feeding frequent small meals and using, as I said, betaine hydrochloride, dose about 500 milligrams of that, and some strong pancreatic enzymes. And for something like this, I generally will use the animal pancreatic extracts rather than using the vegetarian enzymes, because I'm really checking to see if this is going to work. So I want to use the strongest thing available and see if it helps. And if it does, then I can back off to a milder agent and get the effect or become pure and be all vegan. But I really like the glandular extracts, at least for proof of concept.
Okay. Now, are those over the counter or do you get those from the doctor?
Health food store.
And what dosages would you recommend?
Well, that I just gave you the recommendation, 500 to 1,000 milligrams of betaine hydrochloride, and then the pancreatic enzymes vary quite a bit in their strength. So you get the strongest ones you can find, and then you follow the package instructions on those, generally 2 to 4 capsules with each meal.
And the probiotics, is that something in addition as well?
Yeah, and for the probiotics, you want to get an assortment of organisms. As a rule of thumb, I tell people you want 15 to 25 billion, that's billion with a B, organisms of at least 5 different strains, 2 lactobacillus and 2 bifidobacterium. And there's hundreds of different formulations out there. I use one called Pro 5 by a company called Claire Labs, but that's a proprietary company and you need a doctor's order to get those. So
Okay. You
may want to just go with one of the ones at the health food store.
Okay. And one last question, just to make sure he doesn't end up back in the hospital hydrating himself. What's your best recommendation there to make sure he doesn't get dehydrated?
Pedialyte, or Rysolite, which are the children's oral rehydration solutions. You will absorb the water much better if it comes mixed with a little salt and a little sugar. So if you can find a version of that he likes, you can have him drink perhaps a liter of that a day. Now, if he's on, there are certain meds that like potassium chloride or Lasix or digoxin, where if he's on that, you have to be very careful when you add electrolytes.
He, in fact, is on Lasix. He gets swelling from time to time. And when he was in the hospital, he got too much fluids and his legs really swelled up.
Exactly.
So, kind of a
so he's tippy. And so when you use the oral rehydration solution, realize that it's a kind of like an IV and you can overdo it.
Okay.
And you can force the water into the body just like you can with an IV.
Okay.
In general, if a person's having active diarrhea 4 or 5 times a day, they're going to lose enough of that water that you need to replace it. But giving water does not cause diarrhea. That's something people don't really get, and it's important to emphasize to your dad, because old school thinking, if I'm putting liquid in and liquid's coming out, I should stop putting liquid in, and that's wrong.
Right.
Okay?
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And let's go to our next caller, and that would be Kathleen in Santa Cruz. Hello, Kathleen, and welcome to the program.
Hi. I have another digestive question.
Okay.
I was recently, I had a lot of abdominal pain and I went to the ER. They told me I had GERD and they suggested I take Prevacid, I believe was the one they suggested.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, I'm 61 years old. I'm wondering how we can know whether I have too much stomach acid or probably maybe not enough. Are these the proton pump inhibitor type drugs diagnostic for this?
No. And unfortunately, they're vastly overused would be, I guess, the simplest thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're too strong, very effective, therefore, and it's like going after a mosquito with a flamethrower a lot of the time. The first thing is for occasional GERD, occasional heartburn is normal. That is important. It's normal. Everybody gets it. It's not a disease. Take some antacid. And that's really what I start with is antacid, because that's a fire extinguisher, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Or in the case of the mosquito, a fly swatter. You've got a mosquito, you hit it with a fly swatter. You've got, you know, heartburn, take some antacid.
Okay, well, the truth is I don't ever really have what I think is heartburn.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm just saying that that's what they diagnose.
I understand, but I'm just saying that that's step one, all right?
Yes, okay.
So let's say you have GERD. GERD causes multiple symptoms, funny taste in the mouth, bad breath, odd sensation under the breastbone or in the chest. And that odd sensation can variously be nausea, pressure, cramp, or burning.
Okay.
And all of those are variations on GERD in terms of symptoms. So as a trial of diagnosis, you could put someone on Prevacid for a week, and if they're having symptoms every day and you put them on Prevacid and the symptoms stop, then it's like, okay, plausible that they have GERD. Now what are you going to do about it? Are you going to have them take Prevacid for the rest of their life?
No, I don't want to.
No, you're not. It's like, okay, now we know we have GERD. Now we're going to do GERD treatments. And if you go to my website on the resources tab, there is a nice handout about GERD that I've used for 20 years. Nothing has changed about this advice. And I've done this one way too many times on the show to want to do it again.
Oh, okay.
It's very well covered on the website. And the important thing is that once you've established that it isn't heart disease, which I think the proton pump inhibitors are good for, then you seek to treat the condition and prevent the reflux. you previously asked at the beginning of this, is this due to too much acid or not enough? Mm-hmm. And it's not that there's too much acid or not enough. It's that the timing of the acid isn't right, oh, and the seal on the stomach isn't right.
Mm-hmm.
So a person has a flawed valve. So now when the stomach churns, whatever's in the stomach, bile or acid or a combination of both, splashes up onto the esophagus, which does not have protective mucus and is not built to handle that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the symptoms come from that I was talking about.
Right.
So the problem is partly in the sphincter. It's partly in the fact that now it's swollen and out of shape, and there are things that you can do, detailed in the handout, okay, that will help with that. And over time, you get swelling down, you get your seal back, you follow simple lifestyle measures and cautions and avoid things that loosen that sphincter. And often, I use hydrochloric acid with meals in people with GERD with great success,
mm-hmm,
because it speeds gastric emptying. And if a person, particularly if a person's been on proton pump inhibitors for a couple of, let's say, a year, you have to use acid to get them off of it because their body has become transformed. Mm-hmm. And the only way to back away from that is to use the acid to promote gastric emptying.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great deal more complicated than just too much acid.
Right.
And because people don't understand that dynamic, and I include most physicians in that,
mm-hmm,
they go for the quick fix, which in the long run is not a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask another question? They also said that I had sludge in my gallbladder. Could that be causing some of the stomach symptoms?
I'm sorry, say again?
They said I had sludge in my gallbladder.
Well, I don't know what your symptoms are. You haven't actually told me.
I have commonly just have pain in kind of in the middle of my stomach. And
Does it change when you eat?
Sometimes, not always. Sometimes it feels better when I eat. Sometimes it hurts more when I eat. Sometimes it doesn't seem to have much to do with it. I eat often, mm-hmm, and that feels better.
Okay. Well, doesn't sound particularly diagnostic of GERD. You could have dyspepsia, which is just a stomach ache. And generally, that is a hyperacidity syndrome, but it's also very commonly related to stress. Sludge in the gallbladder would more typically cause episodic pain and nausea, particularly associated with the consumption of high-fat foods.
Mm-hmm. No.
So if you're not showing that kind of a pattern, mm-hmm, I'd say the two are likely to not be connected.
Okay. All right, so I'll look that up on your website then.
Yes, I would go there first.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Let me tell you about something in the news that I think is really important. I wanted to put that out there before we go to our next caller. And it's time for me to also give you our weekly health tip. And that's a little feature that I started not too long ago. Our health tip for this week is all about cold symptoms. It's been a lot of controversy about zinc, but the Cochrane Center recently published a review. And I have to tell you, what the Cochrane Library does, it's an international network of experts who do meta-analysis of their literature. And they go through, they pull, let's say, 50 studies on, in this case, zinc and the common cold. They read the methods section. They rank the studies based on their reliability. Sometimes they'll pool data from multiple studies. Sometimes they'll throw certain studies out because the techniques or the methodology or the statistical analysis is flawed. And they try to boil it all down to a thumbs up, thumbs down on therapy. And they recently published a thumbs up on zinc for the common cold. So zinc is a substance that you should be putting in your mouth, not in your nose. Lozenges are the way that most people go. What the researchers at the Cochrane study said is fairly well established when you do this critical review of the literature, is that if you start the zinc within 24 hours of the start of the symptoms, you get about 1 day's sooner relief of your symptoms. And the analysis also found that to the extent that you can score the severity of a cold, there was a statistically significant decreased severity in people with colds. Now, the studies that disprove zinc, that say that it makes no difference, were studies where you inoculate cold virus into everybody's nose and then see if zinc makes a difference in terms of they're getting a cold. And I would argue that that's all very interesting that it doesn't work for that, but I'm not worried about getting a cold from someone inoculating virus into my nose. I'm more worried about getting a cold from absentmindedly touching my lips after touching an elevator button or something like that. So under those circumstances, real-time circumstances, zinc appears to stand up as an actual proven health aid. So that was the health tip. Take your zinc if you think you're getting a cold. And here's the story that I wanted to share with you. And I always love it, just love it, when something that's old and cheap and available and generic turns out to work for a new purpose. This is a new study published in the February 23rd issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. And what it showed is really important. 243 postmenopausal women used a small amount of nitroglycerin ointment on their body every day for 2 years. And then their bone density was measured. They had an increase in thickness of bone, in other words, a bone density increase of almost 25% in their legs. That's as good or better than the maximum response that one sees with the bisphosphonates. So we also improved it not just in the legs, but also in the vertebra, which has been a much tougher nut to crack, so to speak, with anti-osteoporosis therapies. And we all know, as doctors, about nitro paste. We use it for people with angina. The main side effect that was seen in the study was headache. The headaches went away as the body habituated to the nitroglycerin, so it was something that people got over. And the dose used was 1/4 inch of nitro paste. So for those in the medical field, that will make sense. Maybe we should be applying nitroglycerin to the arms and legs of our postmenopausal patients in the cases where other more established therapies have failed. Or maybe we should jump ahead and do this. Now, this is only one study. It's pretty significant results, but yes, we do want to see it replicate before it becomes a common pronouncement. But for those people who don't want to take hormones and for whatever reason have contraindications for bisphosphonates, you know, I'd consider giving it a try. It definitely fits into the won't hurt, might help category of therapeutic input, and I'm all about won't hurt, might help. And let's go to Steve in Salinas. Hello, Steve, and welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. I want to apologize in advance for being the mediator here, but I'm calling on behalf of my wife, and I heard about your show, so I thought it'd be worthwhile. So when my wife was 18, her menstrual cycle started to kind of peter out. And,
18, you said?
18, right. 18. And then by the time she was 19, she had stopped having a period at all. She wasn't particularly, you know, inactive or athletic, and as sometimes I guess is the case. And the doctor wasn't sure what it was, but put her on the pill and said, there, you have now you'll have your menstrual cycle. And she did. And so from the time she was 19 until we got married when she was 25, she took the pill. And then we wanted to have kids, so she stopped taking the pill and stopped having her period, and we couldn't get pregnant. And she went into kind of a slump, started having hot flashes. I meant to mention that, too. Hot flashes are also the symptom. She has hot flashes all throughout the night when right. she's not taking the pill. So at any rate, no one kind of knew what was wrong with her, but the pill fixed it. And then when we wanted to have kids, that was the goal. So we went to a fertility doctor who said that she had hypothalamic amenorrhea, which you might know what that means better than I would. But
yeah, it means that the part of her brain that's supposed to produce the signals to trigger the ovaries isn't working well.
So we used for methods she was taking. We'd use lots of different things.
Yeah, artificial versions of those chemicals. Yes, go ahead.
Right, and then we ended up being able to have two kids, but the problem has still not gone away. And so as it is, she's afraid that staying on the pill is a problem. She wants to get fixed. She wants someone to find out what's actually wrong, not just how to make her have a menstrual cycle. Mm-hmm. She certainly doesn't want to be on the pill for her life.
What's wrong is that she has, you know, a primary failure up there in the brain, and there is no fix for that. There's no cure. We can replace the thing that isn't being made by the body, but we can't cure the condition. And she needs to do something because she'll be at very significant risk for early osteoporosis if she doesn't take any birth control pills and just says, okay, well, I'm just going to be I'm just going to let my body be effectively menopausal. The ovaries work, but the ovaries aren't getting the signal to work because right. the signal isn't being manufactured. We're hopeless at fixing that. We can replace that signal, which is what those fertility drugs did. They were analogs of these pituitary hormones. Basically, sure. the hypothalamus signals the pituitary does its thing, and out come the sex hormones from the ovaries or the testicles. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that chain of signaling, you don't get the output. You can make the output. The ovaries are fine. You proved that with two healthy children, so congratulations right. there.
Thanks.
At this point, if she wants more kids, you're back to the fertility drugs. If you don't want more kids, then you have two choices. You can either accept the potential deterioration of her bones by the time she's 60, because instead of 60, she's going to be like 80 as far as her bones are concerned, because she lost 20 years of estrogen there.
Right.
And so, that's a bad idea.
Well, right now, she's on using bioidentical hormones. I heard you mention that earlier in your show, right. which actually caused me to call.
Right.
And she's using the topical, and that's pretty good, but in the evening she's found that she still has hot flashes throughout the night.
Then she wants to probably increase the dose a bit.
So she's taking a progesterone pill at night now.
Mm-hmm.
Our hope was that by taking the bioidentical hormones and by taking the progesterone pill at night, that she might have a menstrual cycle again with using bioidentical hormones, but it's not happening.
Not if she has hypothalamic failure. If that part of the cycle isn't there, that's not working, you're just not going to get there. You can't reprime the pump if there's no water source.
Then what are the bioidentical hormones doing for her? Simply
the
kind
same
of
thing that
inserting,
the
hormones she needs?
Okay, let me walk you through it. Hypothalamus okay. makes a releasing hormone, sends it to the pituitary. Pituitary then makes things called FSH and LH, which
yeah.
are hormones. They go into the bloodstream.
Mm-hmm.
Once they're in the bloodstream, the ovary picks those up and says, oh, I'm supposed to make estrogen, or, oh, I'm supposed to make progesterone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it works. That's the signal. And when
right.
you take birth control pills, you are supplying the estrogen and the progesterone. So that goes in the bloodstream. And the brain, the hypothalamus, says, oh, there's already estrogen here. I don't need to trigger the pituitary to produce FSH or LH. And
mm-hmm.
we're pregnant, effectively. That you fool the brain into thinking you're pregnant with the birth control pill.
Right.
And so you don't ovulate, so you don't get pregnant. But if you stop the pills, then there's no feedback to the hypothalamus, and so you'd start making eggs again. But if the hypothalamus doesn't work and can't signal the pituitary, which is what her diagnosis says is what's going on,
mm-hmm.
then that's never going to wake up and start signaling the pituitary.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really stuck with her having an abnormal endocrine system that's not going to normalize for the rest of her life, and just taking into account what does she need to do to protect her bones. I'm glad she's on at least postmenopausal hormones, and you need to watch her bone mass. She should be getting bone scans.
Okay.
And as long as her bone mass is not deteriorating, then that's probably enough hormone. But
so the best thing we can do at this point is just damage control.
Yes. There's no hope for a cure here. We don't have the stem cells to transplant into her brain to grow her a new hypothalamus. That's what it would take.
Okay. And now, do you have a recommendation of taking the pill? Like I said, that works, but because of the long-term effects of that, she's worried about taking the pill, I guess, for an increased likelihood of breast cancer or other negative side effects.
The problem is, you know, you're comparing apples to oranges here. She doesn't have a normal physiology to start with. So every woman who has a normal physiology has estrogen levels that are way above what's in the birth control pill every month as she goes through her cycle. So if you really want to think about it, theoretically, the pill should be protective against breast cancer, just as it is protective against ovarian cancer. We've never seen that. We don't believe that it is. But if it was going to do anything, it should do something on the protective end. So I would say that in your wife's case, if she normalized her physiology and was able to start having periods, she'd be at a greater risk for all of the things she's worried about from the pill than if she takes the pill.
Oh.
Yeah.
For her, maybe the pill is a good idea or a good option.
Yeah, I think it's a good option. I don't know all of her clinical situation. She's doing a minimum here, and as long as the minimum is working, I wouldn't push the pill on her if she doesn't want to do it. But on the other hand, you've got to make sure those bones are protected, because that is going to be long-term a big deal for her. And also watch her cholesterol. because she gets to have...
Really, we just moved to the Salinas area, and she really hasn't had a doctor who's willing to give her this kind of advice.
Right,
kind of
I know. You get the cookie cutter, you know, we've got 10 minutes, and
here's what
you do, and take it or leave it. Yeah, I know. All right, so I think that's it for us, right?
Yeah, that's it. I do appreciate your time, and your insights are helpful. We'll try to find a doctor in the area who can sit her down and talk to her like this.
All right. Or you can come, you can make a pilgrimage up to Santa Cruz and see me over on Mission Street.
Sounds good.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's talk now to Yvonne in Castro Valley. Hello, Yvonne, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm calling. I have my daughter is 18 years old, and she has, I guess it's psoriasis on her scalp, and she's probably had that since she was maybe 8 or 9 years old. We've been told it's psoriasis, eczema. And then a couple years ago, she now has, which I guess is a form of psoriasis, but it started out as almost looked like measles or something on her chest and abdomen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's small, like red bumps. So it's totally different than what she has on her scalp and her forehead.
Mm-hmm. Do the red bumps have like scale around the edge, kind of like
they
chrysanthemum
do now.
Kind of, okay.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they do now. They're just sort of small little red circles, and they seem that they dry up at times mm-hmm. and fade. And
okay. All right, but as I'm understanding it, those have not been biopsied.
No, okay. Should they be?
Well, if you want to confirm the diagnosis of psoriasis, then that's what I would do, is get a biopsy. I don't know what these look like. They may be classic, and if they're classic, then it probably is psoriasis. Okay. 99 out of 100 times the classic appearance is right, but there are some other conditions, certain kinds of eczemas that might mimic agutate psoriasis, which is the type that I think they're diagnosing here. In any event, what is your question regarding psoriasis?
Well, and I guess also, as I said, that what she has on her head and forehead is totally different, and she's had that for 10 years. Mm-hmm. I guess my question is, I mean, what they've given us in the past is just, you know, steroid creams to put on the different areas of her body, and not real comfortable having her use those because.
Well, why do we need to treat them? Are they itchy?
She's an 18-year-old girl, and so having cosmetic level. I mean that, you know, her forehead and her scalp. I mean, it looks like she's got severe dandruff to everybody else, and she has this rash on her forehead.
Okay, that's fair enough. I'm just making sure I understand what the motivation here is.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. And then on her body, it's sort of the same thing. She's limited this to what kind of bathing suit she can wear because she has these red spots all over her chest and her stomach.
Well, one thing I would not do, and I would strongly urge you not to do, is not to use the monoclonal antibodies for psoriasis, even for a compelling reason, which cosmesis, while it's important, is not a compelling reason in my book. There are some people who are prescribing Remicade and some of the other monoclonals for psoriasis, and I think it's, except in extremely severe cases, I think the risk-benefit ratio on that is way out the window in the wrong direction. You know, potential for lymphoma, leukemia, and also severe infection versus looking ugly.
Right.
Well, I think I'd go with looking ugly given those risks. But Dovenex, D-O-V-E-N-E-X, I believe, is a vitamin D cream that in some people works extremely well applied to psoriasis. So you should try that. This would be one situation where I would say a tanning bed, not enough to burn, but ultraviolet light can be very helpful with psoriasis.
Okay.
And you may, for her body issues, that may be quite good. So you want to make sure that you start out slowly with a tanning bed. You start out at like 5 minutes, even though you're paying for 15, you know, you don't do 15. You limit it to once or twice a week and you build up to a 15 minutes twice a week dose and see what that does for her body psoriasis.
Okay.
Okay, so that would be something you could do that's relatively inexpensive and might be quite helpful, so you could give that a shot. You can get the vitamin D ointment, and I don't know if it comes in a lotion for the scalp, but I bet you it does.
Uh-huh.
So that would be another thing to look at. Supplemental vitamin D orally, we don't know if that will do the trick, and I'm not aware of any data on that, so I wouldn't necessarily use oral vitamin D for this problem if her blood vitamin D levels are okay.
They're low.
In that case, I would supplement her up to 50 to 60 on her levels, nanograms per deciliter. And let me see, anything else? For the forehead?
Yeah, forehead and scalp.
Yeah, for the forehead and scalp, you might try having the steroids actually injected into the margin of the lesion with a small needle. It sounds dreadful, but I've seen some really dramatic improvement. And if she's a teenage girl and her face is messed up, it might be worth a try at least to get that to pull back into the hairline.
Okay. Do they know what causes this sort of thing? Is it?
No.
Okay.
Short
I mean,
answer.
I read all these things and it says, okay, you know, it's your stomach, it's your this, you didn't eat right or...
Yeah, well, I will often put people with psoriasis on an elimination diet. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So I don't know how to tell who it's going to work for. So I try it on everybody.
Sure.
It's 3 weeks. Getting a teenager to do an elimination diet is awfully difficult.
Right.
So I probably wouldn't go there first.
Okay. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Good luck to you and your daughter.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So let me talk a little bit about vitamin D since we got on that subject. I had two articles to discuss with you. This one, Cedric Garland, who's a doctor who's been very involved with vitamin D research going all the way back, has an article coming up in Anti-Cancer Research. And the researchers here looked at vitamin D levels every 6 months over a 5-year period, and they did questionnaires. They had about 3,600 men and women, average age of 51. And what they found was those who maintained their vitamin D level at 40 to 60 nanograms per milliliter had strikingly lower rates of diabetes, colon cancer, multiple sclerosis, and breast cancer. Now, that's type 1 diabetes, not type 2 diabetes. They got about a 50% decrease in that group of the onset of new diagnoses in these categories. So, yes, lots of potential for confounds in terms of health behaviors. Maybe the people with the higher vitamin D levels are also people who are getting more exercise and eating a better diet, and therefore it's those factors that are causing the decrease in the onset of these diseases. So it doesn't prove that this is going to be the, you know, miracle drug of the world. But on the other hand, I think shooting for a vitamin D level of 40 to 60 is a reasonable goal for everybody. We know that that isn't harmful. And if there's any suggestion that it's beneficial, it's hard to see why not. At levels of vitamin D above 80, we start to see immune suppression and an increased risk of kidney stones. So don't push the vitamin D into the 3-digit level. There's no additional benefit and there's probably some harm. And this study looked at adding vitamin D to people who had TB. So they had drug-sensitive tuberculosis and they were assigned to receive TB therapy, but randomly either given vitamin D supplements or not. And in people not taking vitamin D supplements, it took 6 weeks before they stopped producing tuberculosis in their sputum. And in those who took the vitamin D supplements, it was 5 weeks. So a significant reduction when you consider that for that 5 versus 6 weeks, that person is contagious and can pass their TB on. So it's probably a good idea to add vitamin D supplements to people when you're treating them for TB. Let's go to Barbara in Watsonville. Hello, Barbara, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have been experiencing kind of purpleness in my toes and the soles of my feet and things. And I did try to Google it, and it's probably a circulation problem. And I guess I just wondered what you would say about it.
How old are you?
I'm in my late 50s, and I have had quite a lot of things changing. So,
all right. And do you have any joint symptoms like swelling or redness of your hands or your ankle joints or anything
like that? Well, I do, actually. Yeah. I just in the last year or so, I had a little bit of arthritis. And
Is this rheumatoid arthritis? Do you know?
I don't know, actually.
Right. There's a blood test that you might want to get called a rheumatoid factor.
Okay.
To see. Rheumatoid arthritis is associated with small joint pain and swelling and vascular changes that cause the blood vessels to spasm.
Okay.
And that'll turn them blue and cause them to go numb.
Yeah.
And usually the hands are affected as well as the feet. So when you tell me
they are.
All right. Because if it were just your feet, I'd also say get checked for atherosclerosis of the blood vessels in the legs, which you'd be young for, but hey, you know, there's always somebody who's an outlier.
Yeah.
So that would be something to think about, and that's a relatively easy check. The doctor just takes your blood pressure in your arm and then takes your blood pressure in your leg. And if the blood pressure in your leg isn't 130% of the blood pressure in your arm, then there's a circulatory defect.
Okay.
So that's an easy test. It's called an ankle brachial index.
Okay.
The thing about the vascular spasm that goes with the rheumatoid arthritis and also can come on its own, that's called Raynaud's syndrome. Raynaud's is R-A-Y-N-A-U-D, and that one is often triggered by cold or stress. So if you are finding that this gets worse with either of those two contributors, that would tend to make me think it's more of a vasospasm or a vascular spasm problem.
Yeah, it is worse now with this cold spell. And I was wondering on the short term, because there is kind of a thickening callus of my soles and stuff, if it's good to keep it warm. You know, it just can't seem to
get
warm on its own.
Well, we're going to have to wind this up.
Sure.
Keep your torso warm.
Okay.
That's the place where you're going to get the most benefit. Your torso, if you heat your torso, then you need to lose heat. And so your body will open up the blood flow to your hands and feet.
Okay.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Time to get out those polar fleece vests, everybody. You've been listening to another hour of Ask Dr. Dawn, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. Hey, guess what? I'm now on Twitter. You can follow me at Ask Dr. Dawn, and I would love it if you would sign up and follow me on Twitter, so please do that. I'm also on Facebook at Dr. Dawn Motika, and Dr. Dawn Motika, so please check those out, and thank you very much. So long, and stay healthy.